I call this meeting to order. Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Eugene Connors?
Here.
Councilmember Joan Hanson?
Here.
Councilmember Shirley Dowdick?
Present.
Mayor Ronald Ertley?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Anna Klein excused. Councilmember Douglas Dunn?
Here.
Councilmember Serena Sullivan excused. Justin Johnson, City Manager. Nina Williams, Deputy City Clerk. Britt Hanson, City Attorney.
Thank you very much. Item number one on this agenda tonight, presentation on Aid in Dying by Roland Haldren from Compassion and Choices, a national organization. This work session was called for by Councilmember Hanson. At this point in time, I will defer to her.
Thank you, Mayor. The reason I asked for this is when I was approached by Sharon Rock, I have to admit that I was totally against the whole concept. But after talking to Sharon, I could see where there was room for it. That there, the way Oregon had set it up, that it made sense, and that some people really were in the need to keep down, you know, the people that were in agony from sicknesses, illnesses, disease, and were within 6 months of dying, but were simply in pain. So I'm going to turn it over to Sharon, and she did a wonderful job with coming up with an agenda on this. And this presentation is basically to present it, to make sure that people understand what it is all about, because I'll be honest with you, I did not understand it. So I thought it would be only fair and to bring it up in a council session or as a work session, so that people could ask questions and so people could understand exactly what we're talking about. Because it is an emotional issue, and it's a very controversial issue. So with that, Sharon.
Let me lay the ground rules just a little bit. What we're going to do is have the people that are presenting this, they're going to come up first, and I have a list of their names. And if I get it out of order, if you want someone to go first before you or after you, let me know. And those that might have a different viewpoint, you can follow after the presentation. I thought it was important that everybody in the audience understands what's being presented before those that might have a different viewpoint. And so it's important to hear what it is, and for me too. So we'll start off with Sharon Rock. Okay. Just go ahead and state your name so we have it for the record.
I'm also Sharon. I'm Sharon Stetter, and I've been helping Sharon Rock with pulling this idea together. Joan, I am similar. I was raised Catholic. This issue kind of touches on a lot of emotion. I also had to witness my own father pass away last year of pancreatic cancer, and knowing what I witnessed and knowing where we were and what was happening, it really made me think a lot. So I'm going to say that this meeting we're going to try and keep, as I invite the speakers that we want to have you listen to, we also want to invite, of course, anyone with opposing viewpoints to come up after we make the presentation. But understand that this is a really passionate, emotional issue. There wasn't a single person. Sharon and I collected signatures of over 250 people in the town of Bisbee in a very short time. But understand that it took 10 minutes of conversation for each signature, because every single person who has something to say, it's from a very deep place. So thank you, Mayor, for letting this happen. Thank you, City Council, for letting this happen. Thank you for everyone who's coming tonight to speak or to learn from this presentation. And I would like to say that we have on our agenda of people who asked to be able to speak, and there will be other people on the mayor's list. Our first speaker will be Roland Halpern, and he is the Regional Campaign Outreach Manager for Compassion and Choices, which is an organization that deals specifically with aid and dying. And that doesn't just mean assisted suicide, which is the words that we don't really want to have this associated entirely with. This is about aid in dying. It's about getting your ducks in a row as well, so that we can, when we have that time in our lives, when we get to approach that time in our lives, that we can be at peace with our choices. After Roland speaks, of course, there's opportunity for question and answer, but we have from the floor some speakers that Margaret, you're here. Margaret Hartnett will join us, and then we will have Del Crockett speak, Doug Stanhope, and Danielle Beauchevet. So I will turn this over right away to Roland, and let's get this show on the road. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Go ahead and put your name there for the record.
Okay, thank you. And let me just see if we got our mouse working here. All right, so my name is Roland Halpern, as has been pointed out. I've been with the organization Compassion and Choices for a little bit over 13 years. I have worked in a lot of states where aid in dying is an option, and we're not asking the council to pass a law legalizing aid in dying. What we're going to be talking about is a resolution that would allow prosecutorial discretion in prosecuting cases where someone helps a loved one who is suffering. But I do want to talk about aid in dying in terms of the history and so forth. So just in terms of some demographics that we got from the Centers for Disease Control, and this is just for Cochise County, you've got a little over 24,000 people that are considered senior, 65 or older. Of course, that's 65 is the new 50 now, with the way we're all aging better. And of that, according to the Center for Disease Control, looking at statistics today, or actually from about the most recent census, about half of that number, a little over half, are going to die of a terminal illness. And a terminal illness is going to be like heart disease, pulmonary disorders, things like that. Now, not everybody who has a terminal illness is going to be in a situation where they are looking for a law like they have in Oregon or Washington, Vermont, et cetera. But there are going to be a certain small percentage that no matter what, the best that medicine and technology have to offer is not going to be enough to relieve their suffering, and they're going to be looking for something that they can use along there. In Arizona, you do have a lot of options already. A lot of people are not as prepared as they should be. We don't like to talk about death. And let me just stop here and just ask the audience, how many people here think you're going to die? Well, I guess this is Bisbee, so we didn't get 100% of hands, but the point is we are all going to die, hopefully later rather than sooner, and hopefully in our sleep or in some other peaceful means. But every one of us is going to die, so we're going to be facing an end-of-life situation, and we do need to plan for it. Well, what you have here is you've got the Arizona Advanced Healthcare Directive, which includes what's called a living will, where you can state in writing your wishes if you're no longer able to communicate for yourself. So if I can no longer communicate, I want CPR, I don't want CPR, I want artificial hydration, I don't. And then you also have the durable power of attorney, which allows you to appoint another person to make decisions for you if you're no longer able to make those decisions for yourself. A lot of people name their spouse, but interestingly, 30% of people do not name their spouse because they're afraid the spouse will be too emotional and not carry out their wishes. So that's just kind of an interesting statistic. A lot of people just name their friends or whatever to make those decisions for them. You do have an advanced directive registry, and you're one of the only states that has that. And you can actually have your living will and durable power of attorney uploaded to the Secretary of State website. They give you a number, an identification number, and then if you're found in a situation in which you're unresponsive, a medic, somebody can pull that little card out, look at that number, confirm it's you, and your wishes are then available electronically. Advanced healthcare directives are great, but most people don't carry one around in their purse or their pocket. I don't have one. So the advantage of the having this directory allows you to have that stored electronically so any first responder, any doctor can access your medical records if need be. So I'd encourage everybody to take a look at that. You also have what's kind of progressive. We call it the orange form here because it's on orange paper. In a lot of other states, they call it a pulse, a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. And basically what the orange form is, when you go into a hospital or a nursing facility, you can state such things like, I don't want to be resuscitated if I stop breathing. Once you leave that facility, though, your wishes stop at the door. So if you have a DNR from a hospital, the minute you step out the hospital door, that DNR is no longer enforceable. So what can happen is you can go back home, you can collapse, you don't want to be resuscitated, but your neighbor looks through the window and sees you and calls 911, and at that point 911 has to try and revive you, stabilize you, and transport you. What the orange form says, it's a doctor's order, and it says this particular person does not want CPR, or maybe they do, but it allows a first responder some discretion in what they're going to, what services they're going to perform on you. So that's kind of very forward. There's only about 8 or 9 states now that have an orange form or a pulsed, or in some states it's called a MOST, a medical order for scope of treatment. And then, of course, you've probably recently heard there's legislation pending in Congress that would allow doctors to be reimbursed from Medicare and Medicaid for having a 15-minute conversation with you about your end-of-life wishes if you're no longer able to communicate for yourself. So that's what's available. Current options that you have in the state, you can do nothing, and unfortunately, that's what all too many people do. We're still, a lot of us, in this mindset that the doctor knows best, he or she has the diploma, whatever the doctor says to do, that's what I'm going to do. And you might have heard recently, just last week, they came out with a study that showed that if somebody's terminally ill and doctors are recommending chemotherapy in an effort to improve their quality of life, it's not working. It's actually decreasing their quality of life. But what's happening is the doctor says, we're going to start you on chemotherapy. And they're not telling you about the risks that are involved in that. They're not telling you that you don't have to have it. And that's a problem. So by doing nothing, you're really kind of falling victim to the system. You can seek pain management, and we have excellent methods for controlling pain in this country. But the problem is doctors are not using them because they're afraid that if they give you too much medication, it might hasten your death, and they could possibly be facing a manslaughter charge. They might get you addicted. That's another concern, but the big concern is that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, is going to be watching that prescribing, because these are, in most cases, Schedule II narcotics, and if they think that you're over-prescribing, they will come in and suspend your prescribing privileges, and we've had that problem happen. So a lot of times, doctors will under-treat rather than adequately treat for fear of over-treating, if you will. So that's a problem. You can enroll in hospice, and hospice is great. As an organization, we encourage hospice enrollment. The problem right now with hospice is the physician is the gatekeeper. You can't get into hospice in most situations unless your doctor says, in his or her opinion, they're convinced that you're actively dying. Now, you are eligible for hospice 6 months out from the time a doctor projects your imminent death. The problem is most people are only getting referred into hospice 28 days before they die. So they're not getting the full benefit. We still have doctors that are being taught in medical school that death is a failure, and so they still want to try one more option, one more treatment. Maybe a miracle is going to happen. And then by the time they finally realize there's nothing further they can do and get you enrolled in hospice, you don't get the full benefit because you're not in there for that full 6 months that could happen. There's palliative care and palliative sedation, and in some cases the pain is so severe that the only option they have is to put you into a drug-induced coma, and then after that they withdraw or withhold further life support and allow you to die in that particular method. The question always comes up, what's the difference between palliative sedation and giving somebody a medication that they can take? And people would argue that there is no difference. You have two schools of thought, that the only difference is time, something that's more immediate versus several days or possibly several weeks. Or the other argument is, well, with palliative sedation, you're allowing nature to take its course because it's the death that's ultimately ending the person's life, not the medication. And that's an argument I don't think there's ever going to be a clear winner on. It goes back and forth. There's voluntary stopping of eating and drinking. It's a totally legal option that's available to anybody. The Supreme Court has upheld this on 3 occasions. You cannot be force-fed against your will through tube feeding or through the mouth if that's not what you want. But again, the problem is if you don't do advanced planning and you lose capacity, somebody's going to try and artificially feed you either through a feeding tube or through spoon feeding. And what we're seeing all too often, and we're seeing this on a daily basis now, people ending their lives by violent means, going out behind the barn, shooting themselves, sitting in the garage with the motor running and the door closed. We see all kinds of crazy things that people are trying to end their lives. We're seeing a growing number of murder-suicides where a spouse is terminally ill and is begging the other spouse to end their life, and so they do. Typically, they shoot them, and then they're so guilty or they're afraid of facing criminal charges, they turn the gun on themselves. We're seeing this now every day somewhere in this country, and it's horrible. So we do feel there has to be another option. And that option is basically death with dignity, or what we call aid in dying. Very simply put, it allows a competent, terminally ill adult who's been diagnosed by 2 physicians with an illness that's likely to end their life in 6 months or less to voluntarily ask for a prescription for a life-ending medication, and it's then up to the patient to decide, do I want to fill this prescription? And if they fill it, do I want to take the medication where and when? What we found in Oregon, and we always use Oregon because they have the longest statistics, Oregon's going now into its 18th year, every year 30 to 40% of people who get the medication never take it. It just sits there in the medicine cabinet or in the drawer. They find they didn't need it, but they're empowered in knowing that if all else fails, if my suffering really is too great, I do have this option. So that's one of the big things about it. What aid in dying is not, it's not euthanasia. Euthanasia is the ending of a patient's life, hopefully at the patient's request, performed by a third party, usually a doctor or a nurse, and by lethal injection. The reason we as an organization don't support euthanasia is because control is not with the individual. Control is with that third party. They're the decision maker. I just mentioned earlier in Oregon, in any given year, 30 to 40% of the people who are in control decide they don't need that option. So 30 to 40% in any given year never take the medication. Arguably with euthanasia, 100% of people that get that lethal injection do die. We don't consider this to be mercy killing. Mercy killing is similar to euthanasia, but it's where you have a typical scenario. His mom or dad is in the hospital, they're unresponsive, but it's obvious they're in pain, and the son or the daughter says to the nurse or the doctor, isn't there something you can do to end mom's suffering? And with a wink and a nod, an IV gets turned up, an injection gets administered or something, and it allows the person to pass on. The reason we don't support it is it's the patient, again, is not in control of that. Somebody else is the decision maker in that. Now, what we do know from studies is over 17% of nurses, I see new nurses, have admitted that at least once in their career, they've actually done this, turned up an IV, administered a lethal injection or whatever to help somebody who's suffering. So we know this is going on all the time. It's happening. We also don't consider this suicide, and I want to make this very clear. Suicide is about choosing death over life. It's motivated by some underlying cause or condition, like depression, despondency, can be caught in a scandal. It's something that's temporary, and if properly managed, that individual can go on and live a full and arguably productive life. When you as an individual have been told by your doctor you have a terminal illness and you're going to die in 6 months or less, you've been given a death sentence. You no longer have a choice of death over life. All you're left with is a choice of one form of death over another, and for some people, they would like to have the least worst death, and that would be, in some instances, a death through a life-ending medication. This is just a map, and it doesn't show up there extremely well, but we presently have 5 states where aid in dying is authorized. In other words, where somebody can go to their physician and ask for a prescription, and the physician can write that prescription and will not face criminal or civil charges. That's Oregon, Washington, Montana, New Mexico, and Vermont. And the other states that are kind of green, those are all states this past year where aid in dying bills were introduced. Now, not all of them were successful. In fact, the only one that's still kind of pending right now is California, but these were all first attempts. And basically, no law goes through the first time. There has to be discussion, there has to be dialogue, but all of these are a result of a young lady named Brittany Menard, who was living in California, had an inoperable brain tumor, and decided to move to Oregon and become a resident so she could use Oregon's law. And she went public with her story. It was in People magazine, it was on Oprah, it was everywhere else. And all of these legislators said, you know what? People that live in our state shouldn't have to move to another state to exercise that option. We should have a law. We're going to introduce it. We realize it might not get too far this year, but we want to start that dialogue. In terms of public support, going back to 1977, public support for aid in dying hit 60%, and it's never been below that. So this is the question that's been asked by Gallup all the way back since about 1948. When a person has a disease that cannot be cured, do you think doctors should be allowed by law to end the patient's life by some painless means if the patient and his or her family request it? And it's always been, since 1977, over 60%. It goes up and down sometimes depending on how they ask it, but it's not going to go much higher. You have about 70% of the public that support it. You have about 30% that don't, and that's basically individuals that are opposed to it on moral or religious grounds, and we fully respect that. One of the beauties of the Aid in Dying Law is it's voluntary all the way around. Voluntary on the patient's part to make the request, voluntary on the doctor if he or she wants to write the prescription, voluntary on the part of the pharmacist, whether or not they want to fill that prescription, and it's also voluntary on the part of the healthcare facility. They might say, we don't believe that, so you can't use that option on our facility or our premises. So it's all about control and being in charge of the individual, and if you're opposed to it, we're not going to try and change your mind. We respect that. We understand some people do have strong convictions, religious and moral convictions. All we ask is, because we honor your convictions, we would simply say to those who might believe differently, should you be allowed to impose your own beliefs on them? And I think the answer is no. We do live in America, and we're supposed to have religious freedom. Why people choose Aid in Dying? And there's actually seven reasons. I just kind of condensed it down to four just for the sake of brevity. And what they do, there's the individuals that actually get the medication, they do fill out a survey, and they ask what the reasons are that the individual decided that they wanted to go ahead and pursue Aid in Dying as an option. This is a 17-year average, but at the top of the list every single year is loss of autonomy. And what these people are talking about is in their last days or weeks of life, they don't want to be taken out of their home and taken to a hospital and hooked up to tubes and wires and only have their family visiting at certain hours and being woken up at all times of the evening and be poked and prodded and have everything checked. To them, that's a loss of autonomy. They want to be able to die at home, surrounded by friends and family in their own place, in their own bed, in their own comfort. Loss of dignity is cited by about 80%. And again, it's a situation they don't feel dignified being hooked to tubes and wires and all of these other things. They want their family to remember them as being vibrant and being able to communicate with them, not somebody who's been placed under palliative sedation and the family is just left to watch a corpse until it actually expires. Going towards the end of the list, concerns of pain and pain itself, only about 23%. And what we've really found out is it's not the pain, it's the concerns of the pain. We're really good in a lot of instances with treating pain, but there can be really bad side effects. Christy O'Donnell right now, who's a former police officer and an attorney in Los Angeles and who is terminally ill, she is trying to get a law passed out there because she cannot take opioids. She is unable to get pain relief. She's got cancer that's metastasized. It's spread throughout her body. They can't give her anything to effectively relieve her pain. And so there are some people for which opioids don't work. They can also cause delirium. So you might have your pain relieved, but now you're in a delirious state, and that's bad. We also have people that say you can relieve the pain, but now I'm constantly nauseous. I'm throwing up all the time. I have diarrhea all the time. What's the point? I'm going to die in a couple of days. I don't want to be remembered like this. I don't want to die this way. And at the bottom of the list, about 3% state financial concerns. And we find it's not having the money. We find most people in Oregon, Washington, the other states have some form of insurance. They're just saying, what's the point? Why should all this money be spent to keep me alive 2 or 3 days, maybe a week longer? So these are the reasons that people have given. And these are consistent. We're seeing the exact same results in the state of Washington. The law there has been in effect since 2009. So who used the Oregon law? In the 17 years, a little over half were male, a little under half were married, about 70-some-odd percent had attended college, so you tend to have a better educated group. They understand, they're able to look at reports and read the studies, and they understand the fact from the fiction. 90% had tried hospice. And I do believe hospice is one of the best alternatives at the end of life when you're terminally ill. It's one of the best options for pain and symptom management, and 90% of these people tried it, but for whatever reason, it wasn't enough. And maybe it was those side effects we were talking about before, the nausea, the vomiting, the diarrhea, et cetera. 98.5% had some form of insurance. So again, people aren't using this simply because they don't have insurance and can't afford the care. The median age was 71. That's not old. And the only reason I point that out is there was concerns when the law first passed is they're going to use this law to get rid of the elderly and the extremely frail. And you can see the range there, 25 to 96. I also like to point out 25 because another opponent argument was when we passed this law, teenagers who have been jilted by their boyfriend or their girlfriend or have failed their college entrance exams are going to use this law to end their life. Well, a broken heart, at least for a teenager, is not a terminal illness. And to date, there's not been a single teenager in Oregon, Washington, or Vermont that has used the law. So I'll look at the numbers as we start to wrap it up a little bit. During that 17 years, 1,328 patients actually received a prescription. Of that, 857 actually took the medication, 471 did not. So again, I talked about one of the powers of this is you're in control, you decide when and if this is an option for you. Last year in Oregon, or actually 2013, because that's the most recent year they have statistics for, there were about 34,000 deaths from all causes. 105 people took the medication. That's just over 0.2% of deaths in Oregon. Very, very small number. The median range was 47 days from the first request for the medication and the time the patient actually took it. So it's not people that just get the medication and take it. There's a minimum waiting period of 15 days between the two requests. So you can see not everybody's just getting the medication and taking it on day 15. The longest patient waited 1,009 days. So again, when you're in control, you decide when and if I want this option. And look at this, 95% died at home. When we do the studies, we find about 85 to 90% of people say they want to die at home. Today in America, about 80% of people are dying either in a hospital, a nursing home, or some kind of skilled care facility where they don't want to be. This is a survey that was done last December of 17,000 U.S. physicians. They asked them, should physician-assisted suicide be allowed? We as an organization don't like to use the word suicide because, again, as I explained earlier, we believe these people don't have a choice of death over life, only a choice of one form of death over another. But you can see the majority, 54% of physicians, believe there were circumstances in which this should be permissible, and that was up from 46% only 4 years earlier. The California Medical Association, which has been opposed to aid in dying for over 40 years, recently went neutral on it. They just said, we're seeing these results, we're hearing things from doctors, we don't think we can speak for the medical community anymore, saying that we as an organization represent all doctors and all doctors oppose this. So, we also know there's a back alley practice taking place. This was just a study that was done in 2000. This was among oncologists, doctors that treat cancer patients, so they're more likely to see patients that are terminally ill. When asked, has a patient ever asked you for euthanasia? 38% of the doctors said a patient had asked them to euthanize them. And of that, 3.7% of doctors actually administered a lethal injection, even though it was illegal. 56% of doctors had been asked by a patient to write them a prescription for a life-ending medication. Almost 11% of doctors complied. So this is going on right now everywhere across the country. It's just going on unregulated. There's no second medical opinion like you have in Oregon. There's no mandatory waiting periods. There's no counseling on alternatives like they have in the states where this is an option. And so it's happening, and I think if we accept the fact and realize that it's happening, we have to say, okay, why don't we make it safe, make it regulated, so that it's only used when absolutely necessary. What happens here, this is done in secrecy. The patient doesn't want to involve the doctor, doesn't want to involve the family, so it's done in secrecy. It deprives the individual of the chance to say goodbye to the family. The typical story we hear is the patient's at home, they encourage the family to go out for dinner, to go out and see a movie or whatever, and then they take the medication while they're away because they don't want to implicate them in a crime. And as a result of it, the family's guilty. They're left with that problem. And I think that's wrong, too. Also, convictions are rare. This was a case that happened in Arizona with George Sanders, 86 years old. His wife was terminally ill, begging him to kill her. They had been married for 60 years. He went ahead. He honored that request, was charged with manslaughter. And basically, after a trial and everything else, the prosecutor recommended probation. That's what the judge went with. And so he saw no jail time, but he was still put through that process of not only knowing, he had to end the life of someone he loved because he had no other option, but also knowing that he could face being in jail for the rest of his life himself. This was just what came out of that case. The prosecutor asked the judge not to sentence him to prison, recommending probation. The judge says the decision tempers justice with mercy, and it's very clear he'll never forget that his actions ended the life of his wife. Here we basically had two victims. We had the victim of Mr. Sanders, because he has to live with what he did, and then we have his wife, who is the other victim. I don't know what these cases cost to prosecute. I did ask prosecutors in Maricopa, in Pima, and also down here in Cochise County what they thought it would cost to prosecute a case. Nobody's gotten back to me yet. So I'm relying on this information that I found from a 2001 Arizona study involving non-capital cases. And it's costing about $40,000 to defend a case. So if you take a look at George Sanders' case, for example, $40,000 may have been spent on that case, and at the end of the day, he basically was given probation. And I'm simply saying, is that a good use of taxpayer money? Juries do not want to convict. They do not want to convict in these cases because they have sympathetic characters, sympathetic people up there on the stand, and they understand what's going on, and convictions are very, very rare. So here's where we get to what we're asking the council to decide, and this is a resolution we've already passed in 8 city councils out in California. We're not asking you to make aid in dying an option in Bisbee. We're simply saying that we want you to acknowledge that you respect the diversity of your citizens in making their own end-of-life decisions, that we think that they should be supported in that effort, that we should recognize that aid in dying can be a legitimate practice. It may not be legal now here, but it can be a legitimate practice for some of the reasons we've talked about. Also recognizing that while prosecutions are rare, it does tie up a lot of resources, and that may not necessarily be the best use of your resources. So what we're asking simply for is to consider a resolution that would give discretion to a prosecutor to simply say, do I, as the prosecutor, want to take on this case? Do I want to go ahead and bring this person to trial, knowing that the chances of a conviction are extremely rare, knowing this is going to tie up the time, the financial resources of the taxpayers? So that's basically what the resolution is predicated on. And sorry if I took a lot of time, but I wanted to make sure we had a good foundation for this, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Halperin. Let me make a quick announcement. Some people came in late, and if you would like to speak, if you can find a little piece of paper or something and hand it to the city clerk, you're certainly welcome to do that. Questions from the council?
Who is this? I'm a little confused. If we pass such a resolution, who would it be directed to? I mean, do piecemeal efforts, is that the proper approach? I mean, you probably would direct it, appears, to the county attorney.
Right.
But certainly politics change, and even if you had a sympathetic prosecutor at some point, that could change with time. I'm not quite clear in terms of what the process might be. Would it require official action? I mean, has this been done county by county?
In California, we've done it in cities. We've had 8 cities, such as West Hollywood, Los Angeles, where the city councils have just said, we recognize this is not something that we want to spend taxpayer time and money on. So it's more symbolic. But it's to take a step in that direction, and if a prosecutor knows that they have a case they're unlikely to win, they might be thinking, well, do I really want to take this on? So we're just asking that there kind of be an understanding that if that's the avenue they want to go, that they're supported by the city council on that. And we would have to, you know, I mean, after assuming that you like the language of the proposed one we have, we could certainly talk in more detail upon, you know, about where that should go and so forth. This is new to Arizona. This is the first time we've tried it in Arizona. We've been really successful in California. We haven't had a single city that we've approached turn it down, but we've also been, you know, admittedly selective about where we're going, just like we're going here. You know, we tend to be very open. Things are very progressive. We're also considering a similar resolution in Tucson. And that'll go before that city council, probably before the end of the year.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit confused in terms of how it actually, I know we can pass a resolution, but how someone who chooses to use it would actually work through the system, I guess, being uncertain what the system, how the system might react to this, if we're the first city to endorse such a resolution.
It's a good question, and I can't say that I positively have an answer on that. I'd be happy to get back to you on that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I have kind of a follow-up question from Mr. Councilmember Dunn's words. Once again, I would imagine that the county prosecutors are practicing under state law, and so I'm not sure how a resolution would, he's going to take a seat and maybe answer that.
I thought maybe it was time for me to come back.
It is time. So I'm not sure how a resolution, as Councilmember Dunn was saying, would have any standing.
Right, and again, it's more or less symbolic. We're not asking people to change the law. We're just saying, can we support the prosecutor in making a decision? Again, if he or she doesn't think the case has any chance of proceeding, can they say, I've got murders here, I've got rapes, I've got other more egregious things where I need to worry about taking somebody out of society versus George Sanders? By taking him out of society, what am I accomplishing? It's not for the betterment of the people. It's not protecting anybody else. It's really just punishing him for doing something to somebody he loved for so long.
Mr. Hansen, do you want to have a comment on that or not?
Sure. And first thing I probably should do is make sure that everybody understands what hat I'm wearing when I'm speaking. The first hat I'll wear is Bisbee City Attorney hat, which is Ms. Rock approached me with a draft resolution that was probably a form that looked like it was created in California because it used some terminology there that seemed more familiar to California than Arizona. I helped her put that in proper form for presenting to the council so that if the council chose to act on it, it was in a form that would work. And, of course, I informed Ms. Rock when I was doing that our role as city attorney is not to recommend that the council take action on something in this or oppose it. It is to the policy decision, of course, is always up to the council and not the city attorney. So that's the city attorney hat. County attorney hat is we understand exactly what the purpose of this resolution is, which is it's not to make law. It's not to put something binding on the county attorney's office. It is, as a gentleman expressed, symbolic. Or I think maybe even more appropriate is to have a conversation. There's a lot of people that are here tonight to hear a conversation about a subject that is difficult to discuss under ordinary circumstances. If the council passed this resolution or didn't pass this resolution, the county attorney would always take into account the circumstances surrounding the death. So I would view it as wearing my county attorney's hat is both symbolic and also starting a conversation on a difficult subject, but certainly not anything that would bind the hands of the county prosecutor. So.
Thank you. I have any other questions from the council?
I just want to piggyback off of that, and I'm glad that you presented it that way because that's exactly what it is. It's more like a position that we're taking, but it is not legally binding. It's just saying we believe that people should have that choice if they're in that situation.
Another question that I have, you mentioned that the people that are in the perhaps end-of-life situation, they can take the medication when they want to. In other words, they have it at their house?
Correct.
Is it like in a drawer? I mean, is that dangerous? I guess that's my question.
Well, I'll use Colorado as an example because we had a bill introduced there. There was within that proposed law a mechanism for safe disposal of any unused drugs, and it had to be disposed of in accordance with regulations that the Department of Health had promulgated. But what I like to point out to individuals is any one of you now has something in your medicine cabinet that if you took it could be fatal. If you took a bottle of Tylenol, 100 capsules will kill you. If you're doing two bottles of NyQuil, that will kill you. These are not things that can really easily get into the hands of somebody else. The drugs that are used, they either use pentobarbital or secanobarbital. This is all reported on the department website, so there's nothing secretive about them. They're large quantities, and they're extremely bitter. So even if a child was to get into this, it would be so bitter that they would probably fall asleep before they could even take two or three capsules. We're not aware of this having ever been a problem, But we are now, as we go forward with new laws, and this is not in the Oregon law, but as we go forward with new laws, we're putting a provision in there requiring safe oversight and disposal, in part because 30 to 40% of the people are not taking the medication. That was never contemplated when the law first went into effect.
Okay. Any other questions? Another question that I have. You mentioned the power of attorney can decide to assist in this process. Maybe you could expound on that again. Maybe I didn't understand.
No, that would have nothing to do with this. Your advanced health care directive, your written wishes, or your durable power of attorney would not have any impact on this because only you as the patient can make the decision. And if you lose capacity, you're no longer eligible. So we have had one or two cases that I'm aware of where somebody had capacity when they first asked for the medication, but they lost capacity before they could make the second request, or the doctor questioned capacity at the time of the second request, and they were no longer eligible to use that. But I cannot make a decision for my wife. She could not make a decision for me. They could say, we don't want CPR. We don't want antibiotics if the person develops an infection. We don't want them to be artificially fed. But nobody through a durable power of attorney or through a written advance, a living will, can say, I want this if I'm no longer able to do it myself. We can't do that. That would be euthanasia.
Thank you. One other item. In Oregon, so you have to have two opinions from two different doctors.
Correct.
Are those doctors picked at random, or could they be doctors that you know? How does that work?
It really varies. In most cases, it's the primary care physician who's the one that delivers the bad news to the individual. In a lot of situations, they're already in a practice with other partners. I know, for instance, Kaiser, for instance, would refer them to another Kaiser doctor because they're within that system. So it's typically the doctor typically would refer, just like if you went in for some type of surgery the doctor didn't specify in, they'd say, well, I know this person, they're a urologist, they're a nephrologist, whatever, I would refer you to them. Now, the second doctor can say, you know, I don't support that and I don't want to render a diagnosis, and then you might have to find a third doctor. I suppose it happens, it's really not reported out all that often.
Okay.
What we do know is that of those 105 prescriptions that were written in 2014, 60 doctors actually prescribed the medication. So it means that some doctors are writing more than one prescription, but when you think about it, if you go to an oncologist who specializes in cancer, which is what about 85% of the people died from, they're going to be seeing more of these cases than a general practitioner who might just be dealing with somebody they've known for 10 or 20 years.
And just one other follow-up on that. You mentioned the counseling alternative. Is that law in the state of Oregon where you have to see a counselor to get advice or whatever?
It's not a counselor, but the law, the way the law is stated is, and this has to be documented in the medical record, the physician has to describe all the feasible alternatives that are available to the individual, and that can include, well, they definitely have to talk about hospice, they have to talk about pain management, and they have to talk about palliative care and palliative sedation. They then can go beyond that if spiritual counseling seems appropriate, if there's some other method. I'm glad you brought that up because what we find at this stage in the game, 90% of patients say, you know what, I'll try this. I'll go ahead and try this as long as you guarantee me if it doesn't work, I can still come back to you and ask for that prescription. And we saw that one slide where 90% of the people who had used it had actually been enrolled in hospice, so they had tried that option, but just for whatever reason, it didn't work for them.
Okay, thank you. Any other, Council Member Dowdy?
Is this similar to a living will that you have to keep in your safe or on your person when you go to the hospital?
No, this would be totally different. There's a set of forms that the Oregon Department of Health put together that are used for the models in the other states. It's part of the patient record, so it's not something that you, as the patient, would have with you. The living will, the durable power of attorney, that only comes into play if you're no longer able to communicate for yourself. In this, you have to absolutely be able to communicate for yourself, and you absolutely have to be able to self-administer. That's another precaution in there. Only the individual can take the medication. If somebody else tries to help them, that would be a crime.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the council?
Mayor?
Council Member Dunn.
I guess following up on that also, certainly you've stated the person must be terminally ill, within expected to live only 6 months. and mentally competent. And I, we've seen that many people through that process are going to have deteriorating mental competency. And some, if you do not have mental competency or limited, many in that situation are going to be very on top of it, and many, some are going to be very on top of it in terms of mentally. Others, I would say the vast majority, are not.
Well, anybody who's just been told, or I would say most people who've just been told by a doctor, you're going to die, I think there would be a certain amount of some form of depression. It's part of that Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. But that depression is different than somebody who's been clinically depressed, who has a long history of depression. Now, the law does state that if either physician suspects the person is being coerced by a family member, may lack the mental capacity to fully understand the nature of the request, or they have any concerns about the motivation being depression, being solely pain, something else, the individual has to be referred for a psychological evaluation. So you're bringing in then a psychologist who does that. And in addition, you have to have two witnesses who sign an affidavit stating in their best judgment the individual is making an informed decision. They don't appear to be being coerced. They don't appear to be acting out of any motivation other than they're suffering at the end of life. So there are some pretty good safeguards in there. Again, most people deal initially with their primary care physician. Their physician's probably known them for 5 or 10 or 15 years, and they have a pretty good idea based on what they've been prescribing that individual whether that person does have some type of history of clinical depression. And I also like to point out, I always like to mention this to people, the majority of people who take the medication are taking it in the last hours, the last days, and in a few instances, maybe the last weeks of life. This is not something where people just get the medication on day one and take it. We saw that one example where one patient waited 1,009 days. So I just like to point out these, in most cases, it's people right at the end of life. It's not people that have a fuller life expectancy that are doing that.
Thank you. Any other questions from the council? Mr. Hopperin, you have any other comments?
No, thank you very much for your attention.
And I'll try to get the presenters in order if I can. I probably won't, but we'll
can
find
I ask
out.
You one question?
I'm going to do the presenters first, and then certainly you're welcome to speak. You don't have to send up a note since a lot of people... let's do the presenters and ask a question when the presenters are done. Remind me if I forget. You don't have to send a note up. Just raise your hand after the presenters are done if you want to come up and have a comment. So let me... Del Crockett, is that one of your presenters?
Yes, Margaret Hardin would be the first one.
Okay. Yeah. Just go ahead and state your name so we have it for the record.
These are low enough. Is that good? Yes? Okay. I wrote a statement.
Would you want to state your name first?
Margaret Hartnett.
Thank you.
And I live here in Warren. And I want to take this opportunity to thank the council for taking this topic under consideration, as it's a matter that many Bisbee citizens have faced and are facing every day. I want to lend my support to this initiative as a person who's worked in healthcare for 12 years and in a lay capacity provided primary caregiving and support to loved ones facing a terminal illness. My first experience was as a teenager when my father was diagnosed with multiple conditions as a result of working in the nuclear industry. I watched and helped as his condition deteriorated and was characterized by severe wasting syndrome and eventually dementia. As the medical profession was very unclear as to all of the causes of his radiation exposure illness, they were also without treatments. My mother and I cared for someone who truly, truly hated his existence. And it was only a small blessing when he finally arrived at that state of being unaware of his condition and himself. That was, of course, the hardest time for my mother. And the full toll of this entrapment in a terminal illness was my mother's early death. She preceded him by 6 months. From the constant round-the-clock caregiving of someone she loved very much, but who was no longer really the person she had lived with for 50 years. The other significant episode for me was the death of my then partner, who contracted HIV and died of AIDS in 1989. This was truly a brilliant man. He was a human rights attorney for the city of New York. And he was initially misdiagnosed and began that process of untreated immune system compromise. I think it's hard for many of us to remember those days of inadequate and non-existent care for people living with HIV and AIDS. And in those days, our only option to deal with this death sentence was pain management for as long as it took. In my friend's case, it took over a year. About halfway through that year, he stopped eating as the only action he could take to hasten his own death. And to this day, I recall a conversation with his mother concerning the regular, scheduled administration of narcotics to a person who by then was about two-thirds of their normal size and was non-active. In reality, we had to admit we were just slowly but surely overdosing him, and we both knew it. But that was our only option. My partner's mother was an RN and was very aware of the consequences for her if anyone were to hold her responsible. As a result, I administered every dose on schedule for her protection. We were, in an odd way, protected by the fact that people with AIDS were not wanted in hospitals and other care facilities, and no one looked closely at these patients' deaths, and their doctors recommended that we all take a walk after we lose a pulse so that the EMTs did not come and have to try and resuscitate. Those were a lot of miserable steps. Though we now have better treatments for most diseases, we have hospice professionals to help the caregivers, we continue to face, and I imagine always will, those situations when a terminally ill person is still clear thinking, knows the real state of their condition, and wants to take control of the way in which they leave this world. No one should ever have to think about hoarding enough medication or to ask someone they love to get them a gun or smother them. And I've been asked both. That is not the conversation we should be having about death. As we grow up and mature, we are encouraged to be responsible and take control of our lives, though in the end, at one of the most critical times of our lives, all personal responsibility and control is denied us. The moral code that says life is sacred is deeply ingrained in our culture, but that does not mean we cannot examine unnecessary anguish and then ask, what is sacred in that? In closing, I'd like to leave you with my first major lesson in dying with dignity. My grandmother was raised on the Shoshone Reservation in Wyoming at the end of the 19th century. After she had had a stroke and was partially blind, she and I would talk. She described her understanding of how to have a good death, the one that she had known as a child. She told me of those elders who took the long walk into the Wind River Range to meet their end, their maker, their next life, whatever that was to be. They made their choices, they took their actions, they unburdened their families, and they were highly respected for all of that. We should all get to know such dignity at the time of our death, and we should all have a right to a good death. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hartman. Now shall we go to Del Crockett? Okay.
These things are pretty high for me. Now, am I being heard over there?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm a registered nurse. And I've lived in Bisbee for 13 years. And somebody said to me, oh, I hear you used to be a nurse. And I said, wait a minute. Once a nurse, always a nurse. And I guess that's the way I felt about these things all the years. I worked for most of my working life in geriatrics. I was the administrator of a small nursing home with 30 people. And I wasn't giving meds, but I was acquainted with all the people and saw all the things they needed and didn't need and so forth. And I was very young, and so I didn't really do that good a job. And as a result of that nursing home, I've made friends with people at the hospital who were, this is the Bradford Hospital in Pennsylvania. I made friends with people who were building a nursing home to associated with the hospital. And I was asked to be on the board of directors and eventually was a secretary of that board, and I spent many, many years in the management area of nursing homes. And I learned a lot. I really did learn a lot. It's a good thing. It's a good thing because I've used all those things. And my last job was the most challenging. I was the managing nurse of a 158-bed nursing home. Can you feature anything that big? It scared me to death, tell you the truth, no matter what my experience was. But we all went through it. The county had built this home in McKean County, Pennsylvania. It's a very rural county, but those three county commissioners had wonderful foresight, and they put up this big nursing home. And, of course, a not-for-profit nursing home, which is only one half of the story. So I went back to work for the county home. It was called Senequine Manor. And I made lifelong friends there, including the patients and the staff. I'd just like to tell you briefly about a couple of those people whose history I will never forget and whose lives I will never forget. One was a woman named Dorothy. And she was admitted one day when I was off, and I came in the next day to greet her and tell her who I was, because we had a different supervisor for each shift, of course. And I said, patted her on the shoulder, and I said, "Well, how are you today?" She said, "Oh, don't touch me." And I said, "What did I do?" She said, "I have bone cancer. Nobody can touch me." Now, I wonder how in the world she was going to manage, but we got through that. I sat and talked to her for a long time. She just said, "I'm so ready to die. I can't stand this much longer." She was offered no options. There wasn't anything then that she could have used to end this terrible feeling that she couldn't be touched anymore. You know how important touch is to all of us. And I was shocked, oh, beyond shocked. And then there was Ivan. Ivan must have been a grumpy old man at one time because he was still a grumpy patient. And we allow people to express their feelings, of course. But Ivan had some kind of a surgery before I knew him on his neck, and he couldn't swallow anymore. So he had an NG tube. Are you familiar with the nasogastric tube, which goes from the nose area down the back of the throat and into the stomach? And Ivan didn't like that very well. And he kept pulling it out, and every time we put it in, we were hoping we wouldn't get it in the lungs. You have to test when you put an NG tube in and make sure you're not getting oxygen out of it. But Ivan kept pulling out this NG tube, and you know what we had to do, what the doctor told us to do? Restrain his hands. Now, can you feature lying in a bed in pain with an uncomfortable NG tube down his throat, and he's restrained? I will never forget the look on his face and the way his eyes glared at us, and the way we couldn't help him. We couldn't do anything for him. Well, as I think about it, it still breaks my heart. And then there was Ginny Oliver. She was a dear lady. She had had MS, multiple sclerosis, and was wheelchair bound, but she was having trouble at that point even moving the wheelchair, even though it was electrified. But Jeannie was patient with us, and we were patient with her. We got her up every day, but she was incontinent, and she couldn't really manage to be in that wheelchair all day with no control. I think this is where they had these adult diapers, too. But she was becoming frequently affected by urinary tract infections because of her incontinence. So the doctor said, "Well, Ginny, I can fix that for you. We'll put an opening on your stomach for your bladder." And I had never heard of that either. I learned a lot I didn't even want to know there. He did the surgery, sent her to the hospital for the surgery. She came back with a urine bag on her abdomen, had to be irrigated every day. She was able to sit up longer in her wheelchair. But she said to me, what kind of a life is this? This is stupid. I can't move myself along. I can't do anything but lift it in and out of bed. And now they've taken away the fact I can't even go to the bathroom. I quit. Well, I about quit too. A few of these people will never leave me. And I couldn't do anything for them because those things available or becoming available now weren't available to those people then. And it's a sad situation to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale Crockett. Next on the list, I think it is Doug Stanhope. Is that correct, Ms. Rock?
Yes.
Okay, Doug Stanhope.
Thank you. I have a bunch of notes that I took to try to bring some levity to this situation, and I've cried like a maced rapist at least three times during this presentation. Suicide is something that I have strong opinions about, and I think everything I wrote down is a little too strong, and I don't want to queer something this important from going through. So I'll save all this shit for when Eric Farner's here and I can goof on him. I'll see you when this goes to council.
Thank you. Next we have Danielle Beauchever.
So my name's Danielle Beauchever. Can you hear me okay? So I wanted to thank the City Council for taking this meeting today. Appreciate that greatly. I am a registered nurse. I've been in the profession now for 15 years. I currently work at Copper Queen Hospital in Bisbee in the emergency room. And just for your information, I did let my CEO, Mr. Dixon, and management know that I was going to be speaking here today, and they support me 100%. One of the other things that I do is that I have my, I'm the founder and president of Women and Children's Hope Foundation. And we do a lot of work in town here, but I also do a lot of work in Haiti. And one of the things that I really feel strongly about is empowerment of people. And what I found is that the most important way to empower people is through education. And but what I've also found after working in Haiti is that it's really, really important that we have a strong government, whether that be a local government, a state government, or a federal government, which all three of those things are really lacking in Haiti. So even though we educate people, we can't really. It's a real struggle to empower them with that education, getting them moving within their, whatever their field will be, just getting them employment and then working them through the system in some meaningful fashion. We have a much different situation in the United States, and I'd be always grateful for that. Strong governments and the ability to empower people and make changes with at the governmental level when changes need to be made. And that's a great empowerment for this country and our population that lives here. And thank you very much for that. So it's my opinion that Compassion Choices offers true empowerment to individuals. And they do this by offering education, which is my strong suit. I feel very strongly about that. And on the end of life issues and options. And they also assist people in preparing advanced directives. Okay, so these are two things that are really, really important to me as a nurse, especially in the emergency room, but I've also worked as a med-surg nurse. You can't understand how important it is to have your affairs in order. I can't tell you how gratifying it's been to actually have somebody come in advocating for their loved one and saying, these are their wishes. It calms everybody down. Everybody knows then exactly what they need to do, and we honor those wishes to the best of our ability in the hospital. And then the family has enormous courage at that point, as do the patients, because they've already made it very, very clear. They've thought about it in times when they weren't stressed, they've talked about it in times when they weren't stressed. And then when they were in a moment of great, great stress and duress, they knew what their answers were for themselves. Advocating, as Roland stated, compassion and choices offer, what they really do is advocate for state legislation and laws pertaining to death and dying with dignity. Thank you very much for that. That's, in my opinion, just great work. And that's really important for those of us who are healthcare workers, family members, and the patients who want their wishes honored, and so that people who are part of that scenario are not criminalized. And that's really important for me as somebody who is a player in that. Obviously, I'm not the one who distributes the medications or the, you know, that kind of thing, but I'm still part of that whole education process. And I would like to feel comfortable in that role. And at the moment, that's not anything we can really talk about. So compassion choices through their actions, individuals are able to maintain self-determination through their lives, including their deaths. These patients can determine the quality of their lives as well as the quality of their deaths. It also gives individuals and their loved ones confidence and courage at the end of life. It's my opinion that state laws should respect the wishes of terminally ill people and their loved ones by supporting end-of-life options. End-of-life decisions are private and should be left to individuals and supported by laws. Family and health professionals should not be criminalized when honoring the wishes of terminally ill individuals. This would be the ultimate empowerment. I hope to have the option to have aid in dying, allowing a death with dignity when it's my turn. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boschewitz. I believe that next is it Sharon Rock? I think next. Am I correct? Okay, we have a few people signed up, and once again, on this particular issue, in this particular work session, if you want to speak, and I know some people came in late, you're certainly welcome to just raise your open hand, identify yourself when you go up there. I'm just going to kind of go down through the list. We have Katie Drew Wilkinson. Are you here? There you are.
Yeah, I'm Katie Drew Wilkinson. I don't really have a lot to say about this because it's bigger and more mind-blowing than even I anticipated. And I've been studying death and dying for well over a decade. Because when my mother was in hospice in England, we have something in England called the Macmillan units. And they're special parts of hospitals that are hospice, and they have very few patients and a lot of nurses. And I was given a bungalow in the grounds of the hospital, and I was allowed to be in the hospice situation day and night as much as I wanted to, and my mother took 5 weeks to die. So, first of all, I was very grown up and had never seen anybody dead, so that was a bit of a mind blower. Secondly, I got to sit with a lot of people at night and listen to their stories, because I found that most people, when they're dying, have sort of run out of people to tell their stories to. And in England, as there would be in America too, to a certain extent, you've got an enormous amount of people who went through the war and really want to tell their stories. So I would sit night after night when my mother was asleep and listen to people's stories. But when I came back from there, I was married to an author at the time, and I said, we've got to write a book called The Good News About Dying. And so we did a lot of research into it, and I'm not really going to go into that either, but just know that I've been very fascinated by the subject for a long time. When I was about 19, I went to my father and I said, I'm really terrified of dying. What do I do? And he said, the older you get and the closer you get to it, the more familiar it becomes. And that's probably the most important thing that he ever said to me. I could go on and on, but I just am really, really glad this is happening, because I don't think a day goes by in my life
when I don't think about dying on some level or other, and most of my friends will vouch for that, because I bring up death and dying all the time to them in various different ways, and I just want to say thank you to everybody here for what's happening. I'm just deeply grateful that it's this whole thing is rising to the surface and that people can have hope that they're going to be protected in their hearts and their fears and their anticipation.
Thank you, Katie Drew Wilkinson. Next we have Marcia Gibbons.
My name is Marcia Gibbons, and I live right up the street here in Warren. And I understand the purpose of this resolution. It has nothing to do with authority, but it has everything to do with influence. And I think that's important. And I would be very proud of Bisbee one more time if this resolution was passed. I think I better get off my tiptoes here. Here we go. For me personally, there are many things that are worse than death. That's my personal belief. For a great many people, death is the greatest fear and the worst thing that can happen to a person. For me, it's not. I believe, and I've seen things that were worse than death. Many of you knew my husband, Ransom Burke, and this Saturday, August 1st, marks 2 years since his death. And we had all the advanced directives. He was a public administrator. He was good at this. We had the orange form on our refrigerator. He wore the DNR bracelet. We had the hospice care for 4 months, his last 4 months, which was unbelievably, incredibly wonderful. I also asked him at a certain point if he would please have a very direct conversation with our two hospice nurses, even though we had all the paperwork, because I wanted them to hear it from him while he could still communicate and was still quite clear in his mind. I wanted them to hear it, and I said, please do this while you can, because I don't want them to have to hear this from me after you can no longer speak for yourself, even though we had the paperwork in order. And he did, and I was present for both of those conversations where he just said, I know you can't do me in. I know you can't. I'm not asking that of you. But don't hold back. I'm not a hero. I'm not interested in suffering and in pain, and I'm not interested in prolonging this. He was so tired of dying. And he was a lot sicker than he looked for a lot longer than anybody knew. A lot sicker. And he was not afraid of death, but he was hating the dying. And as a former law enforcement official, of course he had guns in the house, and an enormous percentage of practicing current or former law enforcement people, unfortunately, do take their own lives eventually, usually with a gun. And we had conversations about this, very direct. And 4 days before he died, before he lost consciousness, he told me, take that .38 out of the fanny pack on my door, put it in the gun cabinet, and lock it. He hated suicide because as a first responder, he had seen way more than any of us would ever like to see. And he knew that he was losing his mind, quite literally. His brainstem was going, kidney failure, liver failure. And he wanted to spare me any effects that might happen if he had that brain glitch that then made him go for the gun. I was extremely fortunate because he stayed in his right mind for so long, and he was willing and able to have all these conversations with me. And I was able to have them with him. You don't end up being a cop's wife unless you've got a little toughness in you. I'm extremely grateful that that he was willing and able to have those conversations. We did have a lot of interesting conversations with our hospice nurses. But in any case, many people are not this lucky. I feel he was quite lucky in many regards, and by extension, so was I. But many people don't have that situation, and I'm very grateful for it. But again, I really hope that our council will, more recently, I walked my stepfather to the edge. That was just in May. A six-day trip turned into 3 weeks. And so I've seen a little bit of this. And I know that for me, again, there are things that are worse than dying. And I would hate to have to move to Oregon or Washington, although I have a daughter in each state. Lucky me. I've covered all the bases. But I would hate to have to move if this was a choice that I decided to make someday. And again, I would be very proud of Bisbee to make a resolution which, as I said in the beginning, is merely influence. It's merely support of an idea for those who choose the idea. That's all.
Thank you. Marcia Gibbons. Next we have Susan Blackford.
Good evening. On a personal note, I know there's a lot of sadness and heartache in this room, and I respect that very, very much. I don't think there's anyone in this room that hasn't gone through some painful death of a family member, and we all can relate our experiences. I also would like to say my deepest respect for Danielle and all the kindness and that she does going volunteering down in Haiti. I don't know how she does it, but I admire her courage and I respect her very much for that. Okay, first of all, I'd like to split my remarks in two short sections. These are my opinions. First of all, it's not your place or job to do resolution on progressive liberal ideas, no matter how they fit in your beliefs. Your job is to run this city and not waste time on social issues that should be handled by the state. Has Ms. Rock or anybody else contacted the state to discuss this issue? This is where the matter should be taken up. Your job is to figure out how we are going to survive as a city. When I understand we only have 2 years left of reserves to use, where are the work sessions on this? Where are the ideas of how to make money for the general fund? Until this is solved, I don't think it's your place to spend time on these kind of social issues. Second, and this is my personal statement, none of us are really qualified to make any resolution on this matter. Just because some states think that it is okay, do we have to follow? On a state level, they have people with experience there on both sides of the issue to listen. And then it goes to a vote in a discussion, and then it's usually put on an initiative for the whole state to sponsor. Tonight, you've never heard anything on the other side against this, and I think people should hold off till you hear both sides on any issue. My belief, it is God's decision, not humans, on when we are born and when we die. There are many hospice organizations out there to help the dying, to be more comfortable and make dying easy for them. I know this firsthand, as I know a lot of people in this room do as well. My first husband, at 45 years of age, died of bone cancer, which is the second most painful cancer that you can have. Medicine was available to take care of his pain. With hospice and medical help, he was able to die at home and passed away when it was God's plan to take him home. Don't you see, God has a plan for all of our lives until the very end. There is great medical help out there. No one has to suffer dying anymore. I know when we were dealing with hospice, we were told that if you, as long as you need the medication, you're not going to get hooked on the medication. And the doctors did explain all the chemotherapy to him, the good, the bad, and the ugly, not just forcing him into it. He was explained everything to them. In my opinion, by doing this, you are saying that God's plan for our life does not matter. And I wonder what medical degrees do you all have to decide this? My statement is how arrogant it is to think that man knows better than God. It is a law for a reason. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan Rockford. It seems like I've almost completed my list. Is anybody, before I go to Sharon Rock, former council member Benny Scott.
I'm Benny Scott. I live in Ward 3 and I understood what this lady talked about, police officers. I'm a police officer for 27 years. And I do know that many police officers, when they get into a bind, mainly depression, they stick a gun in their mouth. Now then, what I'm going to talk about is my wife's brother, Agent Orange, United States Air Force. When he was laying in a bed up in Mesa, and they put all their paperwork together, they did everything real well, they had everything, and we knew when he was going. My wife went up to see Jimmy about 2 weeks before he passed away, and then they called. It was getting down pretty much down to the last wire, and so they went back. Well, at this time when they went back, all of the Air Force people and all of the people that take care of the benefits and everything were sitting there, and Jimmy asked one thing. He says, can't I just have a gun? Or can't you get me a pill? They told him, take a pill, take a gun. All your benefits are stopped when you die if you do it yourself. And you didn't bring up anything about benefits and through the immediate family that has any contact. This needs to be brought out, because people will lose insurance. Thank you.
Thank you, Benny Scott. Anybody else? Come on up, and we'll take the lady first, and just state your name.
Thank you. My name is Lily Throckmorton, and I'm a fairly new resident of Bisbee. And thank you for hearing this tonight so that we can get this information out so that we can talk about it and learn. And I think it's very wonderful that this is an informational meeting. I have been I was a registered nurse from 1976 to 1988. And my specialty, what I went into, was home care and hospice nursing. And then in 88, I let my license go, and I have done a freelance nursing assistant for people in their homes. And I have been on the front line of these issues. And I've had several times where physicians have written prescriptions of that I can give morphine so much every hour, you know, that it's a legal prescription, and that I can give so much every hour to keep the person in comfort, and that has always been such a blessing. There's been a few times where it's I have provided this assistance for families, and yet I wondered if someone in the family all of a sudden feels huge guilt or anger, or, you know, has some sort of emotional, mental experience after I have given the medication and correctly, and yet the person dies. I wonder, they could come back on me. What kind of blowback can I get? Fortunately, it hasn't happened in my life. But I have been very aware that there's a very thin line that a family member could have gotten angry at me and gone to the prosecutor and said, I want this woman thrown in jail for what she did to my father or mother or sister or brother. So that is why it's as a first, you know, as an introductory thing, that prosecutors are given the option and the education of what the situation is for people on the front line. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe Nicholas Knight, I believe that's who that is, had his hand up next. Nicholas Knight.
Nicholas Knight, 306 Shattuck Street in Bisbee. Good evening, Mayor and Council, and everybody. Benny, thank you very much for bringing that up. What I appreciate most about the way this discussion is going is all the things that are coming out about it. The biggest thing that is being unearthed is that there's a lot of education involved, and there's a lot of things that people don't know or may overlook. And what I like about this resolution is it brings that out. It encourages that. It doesn't tell the prosecutor what to do or what not to do. It simply gives a choice, and that choice, if you're a good prosecutor, is going to be based on what? Education. And if you're getting educated, the people involved in what you're doing are probably going to get educated too, so you have a much better choice with things. To switch gears entirely, about a year ago, our dog died. Now, I'm sure I'm not the only one with a pet here. Now, our dog died in Maureen's arms, with me next to it, having explained what was going on and getting consent from the dog. And if you want to go woo-woo, that's fine. It was woo-woo. Got up one morning, dog couldn't move, took it to the vet. We were given all the choices, as you should. We could take it to Tucson. We could put it on 24-hour IV antibiotics and oxygen for 5 days, which might or might not take care of the infection, which might or might not let them take care of what was going on with it, and yada, yada. And anyway, there were a lot of options, none of them good. Or we had the option of having the dog put to sleep. Interestingly enough, this was the same week that there was a big brouhaha about the screw-ups and lethal injections. So we can't kill people that we have deemed worthy of death, and yet at the same time, all you have to do with the vet is have a dog that needs to be put to sleep, or a cat, or a hamster, or whatever, and the injection happens, and within 3 minutes, it was done. And at that point, I knew that unless laws in this country change, when it comes to be my time, I'm going to the vet. I kid you not. It was beautiful. Dog went to sleep. Dog left. To step back a moment from that, I think this is your purview to talk about, because you're more than just the governance of the community. Governance of the community is predicated on the social fabric of the community. And talking about this lets us strengthen our social fabric, regardless of the differences in opinion we might have about it. And my hat's off for the people that have brought this up and for your ability to actually put this out in the public. That shows an incredible amount of fortitude, forethought, and care for the community. So thank you.
Nicholas Knight, thank you. A lady in the back was her hand up next. Go ahead and state your name.
Hi, I'm Leslie Lambert, and I live in Bisbee for about the last 12 years. And just 2 months ago, I was confronted with the death of my best friend, whom I immediately married when we found out he had 2 weeks or 2 months to live. His esophagus was filled full of cancer, and he couldn't eat. And I was scared to death he was going to starve to death. Okay? But to me, it's just not the way to go, and not the way to have to watch him go. And the question came up on several occasions, you know, what if, you know? And I just, my point is, I got a new perspective on death and dying, and I had to resolve to myself to know that if it came down to the situation where I was going to watch him starve to death or give him a little too much medication, you know, and he wanted me to, that was what I was going to have to do. And if fortunate, the way the turn of events, everything that happened the way that it did, you know, it didn't become necessary, but it gave me a new perspective on the fact that we do need something, some way to help people die. It was at this time that I learned about going to Oregon, and I've also learned that the property value in Oregon has increased immensely since their new law, and a lot of people have moved there to go and die. And I don't think that there's a lot of opposition, especially not in this room or in this town. Both sides, everybody was invited to this meeting. And I only came here for this discussion. I assume that people opposed to it would have showed up as well, and they didn't. I think that it's a freedom of choice issue, and I think I would also be proud of Bisbee if we stood up for something that isn't necessarily our concern or our job. That's it.
Thank you. Next, we will go, the guy in the front was next.
My name is Roy Mulholland, and I want to talk about a different aspect that I don't think anybody else in this room potentially knows about. And that is, in 1973, I died. And in the process of dying, there were several things that I am totally aware of, and I brought the knowledge back. And that is, I was weightless. I had no pain. I had no worries. And I was aware of everything that was going on. So when we think about death, it's almost as if I turned around and walked out this door and closed it. I would still be, but I wouldn't necessarily be here in this third dimension. So when we have an individual like my mother who was dying, and in my conversations with her before she did die, she kept saying, I want to die. And since I had already gone through death, we had had long discussions about what she's going to be going to. And it made everything different to her. Their elimination of fear. I mean, if you really think about when we talk with people, the one thing that everybody worries about is what is death and the fear thereof. And I can tell you from my point of view, it's great. And so I don't have fear of death. And I don't know how many here actually fear death. Okay? Now, if there's one, which there was, all we can do is hope that we can educate them to realize this is only a beginning. This is only a part. There are multiple things that are going to occur later on in your lives. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mulholland. We'll take the gentleman in the back. Just come on up and state your name.
Thank you. My name is Nelson Hall, and I just celebrated my first anniversary as a resident of Bisbee. Thank you. From 1992 to 1998, I was assistant to the chief of OBGYN at San Francisco General. And we were helping women who had been addicted, got HIV, and were pregnant. And we were able to have babies who were not infected. That was great. Downstairs, there was a ward where people died, and people died in the thousands. And it overwhelmed everything. And doctors didn't know what to do, and they did over-medicate, and they gave prescriptions. And they said, don't take 10 of these. And people ended their lives, and people were assisted, and I wish we had a paradigm. I wish that there had been a system for people to go through so that without guilt, without fear of prosecution, they could have changed how they ended their lives. So this is wonderful. I hope you take positive action. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Back in the corner.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Dukowski, and I've been here on off since high school. First of all, I just want to say I agreed with Ms. Blackford about this is a freedom of choice. You got to be here. People, I saw people on both sides and people who took a more independent route, if you will. I'd also like to say thank you so much, Ms. Det Wilkinson, for the idea you brought to me about, you know, how showing kind of the different ways other parts of the world do things, such as hosting the family member on the possible grounds. I wanted to say this. I believe Mrs. Blackburn made an excellent point when she pointed out, asked if you all have medical degrees, and I think there's a minority here that have anything pertaining to the medical field, which I believe the science, I believe at 15, if you want to go that route, they have more like a stand on anybody else because we just have our more or less what we've seen experiences. As far as it goes, I also agree that Mrs. Blackford absolutely was right on. We said it's really not our choice. And even though I am a Christian, I've been that way since I've been a Christian about 5 years old, it wasn't until more personal experiences where I took a more that route as far as doing. And here's why. My brother Jesse, Sergeant Wachowski, United States Marine Corps, he's out now. His two best friends, he went to Bisbee High School here, and actually from grade school on went out Bisbee, committed suicide. And to this day, it tore him up. In fact, well, I believe when the first one committed suicide, he was deployed, I believe, Iraq. And just when you get word back home, oh, by the way, your best friend just blew his brains out, it tears him up. And it's the most selfish thing a person can do. Now, have I been in pain? I've been in pain for various reasons. As a teenager, where because of family issues, that was the biggest one, where it seemed the best way out. It seemed like it would be best for everybody. In the end, there's a lot of people that would have missed me. There's a lot of people. So when that happened, when Ed took his life, it, like I said, just tore up my brother. And I don't believe it's right. I don't believe the city. I believe anything the state level, people at state level, should be looking at that. I believe that there are other options. And the other point I want to point out is my brother Josiah, when he was barely out of infancy, more like an early toddler, he overdosed on some medication, something found in the microwave, and us older kids, I was in third, second grade, couldn't reach, so we just like, whatever, didn't worry about it. Mom and Dad didn't worry about it, I don't think. He was able to get up there. And the doctor said we should consider just taking him off life support. If best, he'd be a vegetable's whole life and just a burden, da-da-da-da. We prayed, and we stood with him. Our friends stood with us and with him. And you know what? You'd have never guessed that was the case, and that could have been the outcome. He went on to be the captain for the Bisbee Police Explorers Post. He's now too old for that. He turned 21, had to leave his post. And he is actively pursuing a career in law enforcement. Currently, he's involved in construction. You'd have never guessed that kid was, we suggested that we should just let him go. He has a scarf on a bed sore on the back of his head, and he doesn't really talk about it. And if someone close him asks him, he'll share, usually. So that's why I'm really against assisted suicide, because of those experiences. Again, because we don't know. We may get a guy like, you know, someone like my brother, who you would have never guessed that letting the person die was an option. Thank you, and good night.
Thank you. Back here. Go ahead and state your name.
My name's Nancy Weaver. I've lived in Bisbee for 34 years. In the last 3 years, I've had the unfortunate experience of watching two people who are very close to me essentially starve to death. They were both terminally ill. They were in hospice. One was given adequate amounts of pain relief so that he was in a relative state of bliss, although there were a lot of difficulties in the weeks and humiliations and things that he endured that I'm sure that if he had been able to do something about, he would not have had to experience. And in the case of my mother, who was the other, she was in hospice care, and there is no question in my mind that she suffered repeatedly. She died of starvation and dehydration because, of course, she couldn't eat or drink anything. Her lungs would fill with fluid if they gave her any. So she basically, I could go into gruesome details, but it's really just nothing anyone wants to experience. But what I came out of it with was, I told my son when it was all over with, I said, okay, if I am ever in a situation where I can no longer communicate, which happened to both of these people, they reach a point where they could not communicate any further, and I am terminally ill, we're going to Oregon, and you are going to get me assisted suicide, because I am not, do not let me go through what I saw my dearest friends and my mother go through. And I appreciate the city of Bisbee for considering this resolution, Sharon, for bringing this forward. And I think every person has the right to make this decision for themselves. Not everyone believes in God. Not everyone believes there is a plan for them. Everyone has a right to make this decision for themselves, because nobody else goes to your grave with you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else? Oh, come on up. Come on up and state your name.
Betty Lindstrom. I didn't mean to come up. Wait till the very end, except I got a little nervous about some of the speakers. First of all, it doesn't take an MD to have compassion. You know, you don't need a medical degree to feel sorry for a bird or a lizard that's suffering and dying. And certainly it takes a lot more compassion if you see someone you love dying. And I just, I'm very proud of the Bisbee Council for even listening to the gentleman for as long as you did, with all the information and all the education. And it's a little creepy, but 6 people have died in my house. But I have no problem with it. I didn't have to send any of my loved ones away. I was lucky enough to be able to stay and be in attendance when they made this very, very important passage. And it wasn't scary for them. We all held hands, and it was my parents, it was my uncle, a neighbor who said he wanted to come and die in my house because my dad was his best friend at the time, and my dad had passed away, and he didn't want to be, they were going to put him in a nursing home in Tucson because he had no relatives to take care of him, and he was unable to take care of himself. A lot of these people suffered greatly. My dad decided he was going to die because he wanted to take the burden off of his family, so he quit eating. It took him 12 days to die, and it was difficult. You know, I get emotional still when I think about it, but he was an old scientist. He should have made the decision himself. We did have morphine, but it didn't seem to do much for him. He needed something else, and he wanted to make he made this decision, and, you know, I threatened at one time to put an NG tube down him, and he gave me the look like he did when I was 10 years old and I was questioning his authority, so I didn't dare, you know. But it took him 12 days to die. It was hard on him. It was hard on me. And thank you all for your great comments. And even Benny, I disagree with you so often, but here you brought up something that we've never thought about. You know, people lose their, they might do suicide and lose their benefits, and we need to look into that, you know. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Betty Lindstrom. Anybody else from the audience? We will now go to...
64 seconds to redeem myself.
You want to redeem yourself?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
You never want me to speak. Don't put me up after someone who makes me cry. Put me after someone who makes me mad.
Once again,
I just want to go over a couple things.
Doug Stanhope.
I assume Doug Stanhope, I live at 212 Van Dyke or 326 Hazard, depending on the mood of my wife. I just want to let you know a couple of things, because we've already had the God thing that everyone anticipated. which you can't argue with that.
So what that God argument will become, assuming this goes to a resolution at the next council meeting, is fantastical hypothetical situations. You're going to hear that, well, if this passes statewide or countrywide, insurance companies, unscrupulous insurance companies, will try to force people into an early death, which if you've ever dealt with suicide, which evidently everyone here has, it's not a choice that some number cruncher from Blue Cross is going to talk you into. It's a devastating situation. So, yes, you're going to hear people say, oh, the insurance companies, greedy heirs, will try to talk their own family into killing themselves. Just be aware of the BS that you're about to face once the Jesus folks start turning this into hypothetical situations that don't really happen and you watch too much movies. Every one of us wants to be surrounded by our loved ones when we die, and death doesn't work like that. If I were to have terminal cancer, and I'm smoking a lot more than normal just because I want to be on the forefront of Bisbee progressivism, I want to be the first assisted suicide in Bisbee. I came out of the closet and became gay just because of civil unions, and I've burned every plastic bag I've ever seen. I want to be surrounded by my loved ones like you, and it would be far more convenient if I could just send out a mass email saying I have stage 4 lung cancer, I'm dying at 7 o'clock Sunday night right after the Packers game. Get here early. Bring beer.
Thank you. Doug Stanhope. Anybody else? We'll close off with Sharon Rock.
Sharon Rock. I'm a Bisbee resident and I have lived here for over 14 years. Do you need my address? 136B Quality Hill. I know we've been here a long time and I appreciate all of your patience. I don't want to make this much longer, but I would like to say a couple of things. I'd like to respond to Susan Blackburn. Yes, I got some very good advice from the very first person that I talked about this resolution with, which was with Mayor Ertle. He suggested that I speak with our district state representatives and our state senator. I contacted all of their offices in May, and I have yet to speak with any of them. They're, I think, very afraid of this issue, but they have not completely shut me down. And I'm very excited about that. Speaker Gowan's office may end up, I may get a meeting with him in Sierra Vista in October sometime. And our state senator, Gail Griffin, her office told me that the senator had asked her aide to put this information into a pile that she would look at in the fall. So, yes, we are working on this here at the state level. And because of that, or in addition to that, that's why this resolution, to me personally, is so important. If I'm going to speak with these people, I would very much like to have wonderful Bisbee behind me, and not just be speaking to them as Sharon Rock, but as the first city that had the courage to pass this kind of resolution. So that's one thing. And with that, actually, I would like to ask the council, because I believe that it takes two council members or one council member and the mayor, to put this resolution onto an agenda for one of your regular meetings. Is that something you can do at this meeting?
No.
No. Okay. Then we'll work on that later. With that, then, all I would really like to do is just thank everyone here each person here who came up here and spoke or came here and sat and listened and learned and had feelings that came up during this. I think you are all very respectful to one another, and I think more than anything, I appreciate that most. I'd like to just thank again the mayor and council for permitting this to happen. And I'd like to very much thank Roland Halpern from Compassion and Choices. The organization Compassion and Choices didn't even know that he was coming here to do this because he did it on his own time and money. So, I'd like to thank Sharon Stetter. She's been by my side the whole time as we've been working on this. And each of our guest speakers, I'd like to thank Lizanne Michaud. She's been behind the scenes from day one when I brought up this idea, and she has been instrumental in making things happen. And you, none of you would ever even know that. But again, and thank you all for your participation.
In closing, certainly the council can comment. I want to thank Ms. Rock and Mr. Halpern and all the presenters. It was a lot of detailed information, and I am not an expert on this issue, but I certainly learned a lot of detailed information, and I think it was an excellent presentation, as a matter of fact, and so it answered a lot of my questions that I did not know. Councilmember Hansen asked for this to be a work session, so if I would defer to her if she wants to have a final comment.
I, too, would like to thank Mr. Halpern for his great presentation. I think it went a long way in explaining a lot about death and dying and doing it with dignity. And as I said before, when I first talked to Sharon, I wasn't really sure that I was, you know, I was going to be very much help to her. But she did a wonderful presentation to me, I mean, personally. And it just made so much sense that we need to educate everybody on this issue. So thank you very much, Sharon. Thank all of you for coming. I wish that we did have more people who were not in favor, just to see, you know, why they were. And I do think it is important that they be heard. But thank you all for coming and sharing all of your stories and your thoughts and your opinions.
Thank you. And I will just finally add to that and reiterate what Councilmember Hansen said. Thank you all very much for coming out and sharing your very heartfelt stories. That was quite an experience. Any other comments from the council? Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
We have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor indicate by saying
aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Motion passes. This meeting is adjourned.